welcome to Healthbeat Poets podcast. I'm Helen Shepherd, a poet who's worked as a midwife and writes about birth, health, the complexities and joys of caring, and those whose voices are often unheard. Healthbeat Poets, for your podcast pleasures, are the spoken word poets who connect with communities around health. Expect fantastic stories and exceptional poetry.
Today, I'm absolutely thrilled to be introducing Stephen Lightbound.
Stephen is a UK-based poet and disability rights champion. He writes extensively, but not exclusively, about his life as a wheelchair user. In June 2021, his second poetry collection, The Last Custodian, will be published. Yay! Stephen's website and his social media is at Spoke and Pencil. Stephen, I've heard your poetry at many events and enjoyed your book launch of Only Air, where you had lots of diverse poets there, and it was a real celebration of poetry and actually well-being. What I'm interested in is why poetry?
Yeah, well, that is the eternal question with a big question mark at the end of it, as in terms of why poetry. I think it's I'm really pleased that you mentioned that launch for Only Air, which was my first collection, which was out in 2019, and that I guess was a culmination of thoughts and thinking of being 25. Well, it would have been 23 years or so post my accident when I was 16. That left me as a wheelchair user. And I don't know, through the time in the years after my accident, I kind of found many ways of trying to deal with it, come to terms with it, and understand what had happened to me. Never necessarily successfully. A lot of those things that I was doing was about trying to prove people wrong, that maybe I was projecting onto them things that maybe I was thinking about myself, about things that I couldn't do or wouldn't be able to do. And I was finding myself sort of perpetually angry and pushing myself very hard. So I was doing lots of endurance races, marathons and triathlons and long distance swims and all that sort of stuff. All very exciting, all very good, all very demanding of the body. But I didn't necessarily feel like I was coming to terms. I was just pushing myself to the nth degree to still prove that I could do things that maybe I didn't think I could do, or maybe I thought other people didn't think I could do. And then around 2013, I sort of had a bit of a, we talk about 2020 as being a bit of a horrendous year. For me, 2013 was a pretty bad year. My first marriage ended. I lost my stepfather, and I was in a really, really difficult job that was asking a hell of a lot of me, involved a lot of travel nationally, was very high profile, and I was under a lot of pressure, and all of that happened within about 4 or 5 weeks, and I really felt burnt out, and I was finding myself then living on my own, coming to terms with a lot of this stuff. I just took myself off to a poetry course that was led by Malaika Booker in London. I really loved it. I had no background in poetry. I didn't read poetry. I didn't write poetry, but I was just wanted to do something that was pushing me creatively. And in this course that we did with Malaika, we had to write a letter poem. And I wrote a letter to my legs. And then the second part of the letter, the poem, was a response back from my legs. And I sort of read it. It's a sort of fairly basic poem. It's not, you know, it's not groundbreaking, but it was for me. And I shared this with Malaika, and she said, I think there could be something in this. I think, you know, there's other poems to write on this subject. And I went away, and that's what I did, and wrote, and I just couldn't stop. I was just, so for me, it wasn't about form. It wasn't about whether or not these poems were any good. It wasn't about whether or not they were going to be shared publicly. For me, they were about understanding what had happened and kind of making peace with the thought process. And what I found is that the more I wrote, the more I dug deeper than the sort of superficial thinking that was at the front of my head. I sort of came to terms more with what I was thinking, and, you know, the sort of labels that I was putting on myself. Then what naturally started to happen was that I then wanted these poems to become better. And I started to read other poems and I started to immerse myself in poetry. And I wanted to then think, actually, if I'm going to spend a lot of time writing these poems, maybe I would quite like to share these with other people. Maybe I'd quite like to try and change some, you know, if I'm changing my own perceptions about myself and disability, then maybe I can do that externally with my poems. And that's how the first collection On the Air came up, which is a sort of culmination of 20 years experience of being a wheelchair user, which is a very long and winding answer that's probably taken up your entire podcast time. But it's not an answer that I can sort of give succinctly, really, because it's a culmination of 20 years or so.
And I think many poets will have a similar story and completely different stories about how they got into poetry. And like you, I started writing in my 40s, so it is surprising, and, you know, through needing to write at that time. All artists have needed to embrace online events, and I've been to quite a few of yours. I enjoyed your Instagram. What have you been up to, and how have you found taking to sharing your spoken word online?
Yeah, I think, you know, I feel like in some respects maybe there's a need to caveat the fact that actually 2020 I found quite good creatively. I've sort of been able to use the time indoors to spend some of that time kind of flexing my creative muscles a little bit. And I've been able to use it to finish off some projects. So the book, the second poetry collection that you mentioned, I've been able to finish writing. I've finished writing a children's novel, and I've written a sort of one person play. That's not to say, well, look, I think these are like, oh, look at me, I've sort of been able to do all these fantastic things. But these are things that have been in my head that I've needed space to be able to get them down. And I've appreciated the time to be able to do that. I've also stopped. My day job was in the NHS, working in communications. And I've been finding it increasingly difficult over the past years to manage my own health needs and leading a team and working in a sort of fairly high profile role. And so I've had to take the decision to step back from work and focus on my health for a bit. So actually I've had a lot of time. I've had a lot of time at home, not thinking, not doing things. And so for me, not wanting to kind of model and focus on my own health, I've thrown myself into creativity. What I've found is that online has created this world that has become more accessible to me personally. Now, I say me personally because I think it is important, again, to caveat that actually online hasn't necessarily felt accessible to a lot of people. You know, if you have a visual impairment or if you have hearing difficulties, you know, not that many events have been able to move towards captioning or VSL or audio description. But for me personally, not being able to ask questions about whether or not a venue has wheelchair access or a disabled toilet or if there's a lift up to the stage or if there's a ramp or all that sort of stuff, I found it incredibly liberating to just be able to open my laptop and log into an event, whether that be in Bristol or Alabama. You know, it's been great. Not that I'd love to dial into an event in Alabama, but I mean, I've watched stuff in America and I've watched stuff in other countries, and I've just turned on my laptop, and I think that's been great. And what I have done, and you mentioned my kind of live events that were in person and that they were diverse, I think I learned a lot about accessibility through doing those events. I said that my events were fully accessible, and they weren't. My events were fully accessible to me or people that had disabilities like me. And I learned a quick lesson when people were coming to my events and said, oh, there's no induction loop, or we can't hear the poems or whatever. Yes. You know, I didn't want to be, I felt awful that potentially people could be feeling like I do when I turn up to a venue and it says it's got access and then it's got five steps up to the venue. I didn't want to put anybody in that situation. So I think, you know, I kind of learned a lot in that process. And then again with online, I naively assumed that online would make things a lot more accessible to people. And I realized that actually it's made, for a lot of people, it's just kind of doubled down on the inaccessibility, and particularly at a time when people are feeling isolated, it's made people feel more isolated. So actually, again, there's been a steep learning curve for me in terms of accessibility. Now, I think there's certain things that any poet can do that is reading at an online event. And that one of those is to just say, I'm going to make my, all the poems that I read, I'm going to make available in PDF and put them into the chat. So that if anyone wants to read along, then they can do that. And I don't think that's incumbent on the event to do that. I think that is the poet can do that. That's not causing anyone any issues. I think some people are worried about copyright. I think if a magazine isn't going to take your poem because you've decided to share it so that someone with hearing difficulties can read along, then you don't want to be in that publication. You know, if they're going to say you've already made that poem public to 12 people so that one of them can read it while you speak your poems, I think that's not a publication you want to be in. So I think, you know, the minimum that any poet can do is say, I will make a PDF of my poems available. And then I think we can grow from there. I think we're still trying to learn about this forum that is for good. And I hope when the dust settles and we end up in whatever world we live in on the other side of this, I really hope that online events stay. I think I ran some events through my Instagram. So I did some Instagram live events again, which is the minimum that any poet can do. You know, you can have a conversation with other poets. You could get a BSL interpreter, of which there is obviously a cost involved in that. You could share your poems online. I stopped during that, I think, not because people weren't watching, but I think because, as I say, I was going through this process of stopping work and focusing on my own health, and I was struggling to do everything, I think, at the same time. So I needed to take a step back and just kind of focus on myself. But I would like to set that up again. And I think, yeah, online events would be terrific if they were here to stay. And I think if festivals, people, you know, we're never going to replace that. There's nothing is ever going to beat the feeling of being on a stage behind a microphone and reading to a live audience and kind of feeling that energy. But also I think we have to accept that for a lot of poets, that's incredibly stressful. And I think actually for a lot of poets, there's a safety in being on the laptop. You can still share your poems. You don't have to live in Bristol and then have to drive up to Newcastle to read at a poetry event to sell 7 books and then drive back again. I think there's no reason now why these can't be, you know, you can't do an event and project someone from Zoom onto a wall so that an audience can read. You know, I think it really should open up accessibility to not just people with physical needs, but people that are anxious about traveling or people that can't travel for financial reasons. Yeah, there's a whole potential, I think, that it brings, and it hopefully it brings to a fascinating period where we hear from a lot more people than we were doing before.
I'm absolutely with you in that you can go to events all over the world, everybody can access because the equipment is available. It would be brilliant when live events open up, poets that can be projected onto a screen and included, and also the events are available online to watch or pre-recorded. I've really enjoyed watching events that are happening across the globe at unsociable hours that I can re-watch again. One of the things I was interested in is that you started to bring a little Lego figure to your reading, and I thought that was ingenious.
Well, the reason for doing that is I have a small Lego figure of me that sits in a little Lego wheelchair on my desk. And what I realized, which it was a sort of personal epiphany, which has been really fantastic, was I hadn't realized how much of my identity I felt like I'd missed by reading on Zoom readings. And I say that because when I'm in person, I hadn't realized actually how much of me reading my poems about my disability people will relate to, because they can see me sat in my wheelchair.
Yes.
And I think it catches people's attention because they see the chair and they're not knowing what's going to come. And I'm sharing stuff that maybe people haven't heard before, or maybe there's not as many poets. You know, there are lots of poets with disabilities writing and sharing poetry, but we are in a minority group of poets that have exposure. So I think when I rock up to an event, I think people take it, catches their attention. Online, you can't see the chair, and I had realized I'm sort of this, you see my head, shoulders and chest, and I'm just this white 40-year-old bloke. And it's really interesting in the sense that actually It's also made me realise a lot more of my privileges that maybe I've kind of ignored or felt that I haven't had compared to other poets, because I've just kind of been focusing on my own chair. And yeah, I think when I'm reading my poems, it's helpful to remind people about my disability, because otherwise I just look like I'm just randomly reading poems about being a wheelchair user. I don't know if that makes sense. I don't feel like I'm still trying to understand that, and I don't feel like I'm necessarily articulating it well yet, because I'm still trying to put that together. And I think when I talk about my own privileges, I'd say that because I am one of the people that I spoke to during the summer was a black female poet in a wheelchair who's a wheelchair user, and she was saying, you know, like, there's three things I have to kind of fight to get equality. And it made me think, oh yeah, there's only one thing I'm fighting for. And actually, on Zoom, that thing that I'm fighting for is taken away. And then, so, you know, in readings or in things that I'm doing or people that I'm talking to, that actually I can do more in terms of making sure that when I talk about diversity or events that I do, I'm thinking more than just my own personal experience of being a wheelchair user. It's been really, really helpful for that as well, I think. Again, as I say, it's coming out muddled and might not make a lot of sense, and people might go, I don't know what he's talking about, or classic 40-year-old bloke, you know, type thing. But it's interesting to still be trying to ask those questions of yourself.
And also thanks, Stephen, because also the poets that you had as guests on your Instagram were so diverse, and the black poet, I can't remember her name, was absolutely stunning, the way her poetry took you, the listener, out of her life and around
Miss Jackie
back in again. And
It was Miss Jackie,
and Ilya and all the other poets were fantastic. I'm just going to ask you one last question, which is, I'd love to hear more about what inspired The Last Custodian, because I've had a sneak peek at the cover, which is spectacular, and also some of the poems, and your storytelling and what you have to say is just so intriguing.
Thanks, Helen. I think The Last Custodian for me is it's a weird little book of poems, and I'm really pleased that Bernie and I, of who we share a publisher in common, have allowed me to put this book out, because it is weird and it's very different to what I've written before. When I wrote Only Air, that was my experience as being a wheelchair user. And I think The Last Custodian is a fictional account of someone who is a wheelchair user who wakes up one day and finds that there's been an apocalypse overnight, and that they believe that they are the last survivor. And they set out to trek across the south of England in their chair to see if they can find anyone else alive. And there's a lot of things have been done about that. There's a lot of reasons why I've wanted to write that. One, I think, is just in general, I've watched a lot of films during lockdown, but just in general, and I'm always frustrated in sci-fi when the person with a disability tends to get killed off first or be seen as a bit of a hindrance. And I never feel as though that's a realistic representation of somebody. I mean, just in film in general, who uses a wheelchair. And, you know, I often wonder what would happen, you know, like, would this person be able to get there? Medication, would they get their medical aids, you know, where would they get their equipment from, and all that sort of stuff, and none of that is ever addressed. And I think, you know, you've probably not got time to go into detail in that in a 2-hour film, but I wanted to explore some of that in a sort of dystopian world someone could survive, you know, because a hospital would still be empty, you could go and rifle that for supplies and things like that. So I wanted to do that. And actually, one of the things that I find a lot is that when I'm out and about, people come up and assume that I need help, whether that's reaching something off a shelf in a shop, whether that's pushing up a hill, whether that's crossing the road. The amount of times that somebody would come up to me and say, do you need any help? And I'm like, no, I'm fine, thanks. And in this book, I wanted to show, actually, it's not a stretch of the imagination that someone could survive on their own and push across the country of a barren landscape and not need any help. You know, and but also it flips it, and at times that person does need help, and they have to accept that at times they do need to ask for help, and that they, and I think also it's been written during a period of isolation, and I think for a lot of people with disabilities, they feel as though they are secluded and isolated from society in general. And I flip that on its head. And a lot of that times you can feel isolated outside. You can feel as though your differences are exposed when you're outside and you can't get into shops, or you're not able to do things that other people are doing that you see around you. And actually, there's a liberation that comes from not having this rammed down your throat when you're outside. Mm-hmm. And I think the sort of guilt that this person feels for being happy that they are the last person because they're unencumbered from the stereotypes and the perceptions of other people. So yeah, and I've just enjoyed inventing characters and scenarios, and there's probably a bit of me in there, but and also I'd like the fact that actually there's a lot of gaps left that people, I've shared it with a couple of people and they say, oh, actually there's a lot of gaps, and I'm like, well yeah, that's for the reader to fill in, you know, that's that there's, you know, these poems are written across 365 days, but there's only 50 odd poems, so there's a lot of days for you to decide what happens in between.
And there's a real sense of human story and endurance as well as hope. And I'm not going to say any more, but I was interested in the stones, but we'll let the reader find their own way with your...
Well, I'm happy to say, I think, because I've sort of spoken about these stones publicly, I think they are, in lieu of having a family, he collects a group of stones and writes initials on them and then carries them around in his rucksack and talks to them as his family. So throughout the book, he has conversations with various stones. So he has this conversation with a stone with a G written on that, and that's his granddad. He has a conversation with a stone with a D written on it, and that's his dad. And a conversation with a U written on it, and that's the U is his wife. So when he says, I miss you, that's his wife. So yeah, that's the kind
brilliant conversations concept. That he has throughout. Stephen, would you like to share a poem with us?
I will read one through The Last Custodian. Let me see if I can find one. Just for a second. You might be able to edit these ums and ahs out, Helen, while I find it in my laptop. I forgot I was going to read a poem.
And Stephen's book, The Last Custodian, will be available through Burning Eye Books and June, I believe.
Let's read, that's true. Let's read the first poem. So this is day one. So this is, this is where Luke, who's the character, decides that he's going to leave the apartment that he's shared with his wife, who's no longer with him, and he decides to set off into the world on his own. So this is day one, Bristol. I drink the juice from the tin peaches, gulp down survivor syndrome, ignore the urge to add cream and ladyfingers. Thinking of dessert doesn't seem right when I can't smile at you across our table raised on 4 yoga blocks. A small ooze of sugar water escapes from the tin and settles in my beard. I leave it, fantasize about an exhausted bee replenishing itself on my chin. I wipe the sticky residue away with a grubby hand. I'm so bereft of contact that the thought of a bee coming for pleasure, then leaving to return to the hive revitalized, is simply too much.
Gosh, Stephen, that's stunning. So full of imagery as well. Really sets the scene about your journey ongoing and onwards. I'm just going to finish now by thanking you. Thank you for sharing all of your journey into poetry and also your take on health, because it's an important time for us to think about this. And poets absolutely hold the key in expressing where we are at the moment, and absolutely full of joy, adventure. Thank you very much, Stephen, for your time.
Pleasure. Thanks, Helen. Thank you.